When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The podcast where we talk to smart people, but not necessarily done by smart people.
That is an awesome question.
This one goes down probably on one of my top five.
Hey, I like nutrition. I like to eat food.
This is the coolest thing ever. We're going to do this forever.
I wish I paid more attention in that class.
You know, I'm going to be honest. I don't understand that. As a man, I don't get it.
Welcome to smartpeoplepodcast.com.
Hello and welcome to Smart People Podcast, conversations that satisfy your curious mind. Chris Stemp here, as always. Thanks for tuning in. I know that a lot of you listening are curious overachievers who want to put your stamp on this world, who want to have impact. And I also know one of the greatest things that prevents that from happening is perfectionism. And that's what we're discussing this week on the show. And I specifically like the angle we take with our guest this week, because it's talking about the idea how perfectionism can be a trap. And I think we all feel that at times. You know, I've seen in the corporate world how often we are pushed to be perfect, to always receive feedback, to execute on the razor's edge, all in the name of incremental gains. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it takes its toll. This week on the show, we are interviewing Thomas Curran on his brand new book, The Perfection Trap, Embracing the Power of Good Enough. Thomas is a professor of psychology at the London School of Economics and author of the landmark study that the BBC hailed as the first to compare perfectionism across generations. His TED Talk has received more than 3 million views, and he's been featured all over the place for his work. This interview and Thomas's book is meant for anyone who has ever felt overwhelmed by the often soul-crushing need to not just compete and not be great, but to be perfect. And what I think you'll find, and I hope you'll find, is this conversation gives you the grace to realize you can accomplish in a more sustainable way. Here it is, my conversation with Thomas Curran on his new book, The Perfection Trap, Embracing the Power of Good Enough. Enjoy. I have this theory, and it is that most people believe they're perfectionists, but in fact, many aren't. How do I know if I'm a perfectionist or not?
Okay, the biggest telltale sign. So perfectionists can come in many different flavors, for want of a better word, and there's no one size fits all. But I suppose the biggest telltale sign is if you succeed, if you do something well, what's your first emotion? Because if it's relief that you didn't screw up, then it's probably a high chance you've got some perfectionism there. Because that's essentially what perfectionism is. It's a deficit thinking. It's a concealment and a hiding and a disguising of our frailty, shortcomings from the world. And so all we really care about is not screwing up. It's not really about success. It's about not screwing up. And if you feel that relief when you've done something well and not that pride and that, you know, real sense of accomplishment, then you might be a perfectionist.
We've been talking a little bit before hitting record, and you seem to me to be a kind of laissez-faire, you know, let happen what happens. And look, so how do you write about perfectionism yet have this persona of what happens, happens?
Well, this has been a very, retrospective fit of my life story as I tell it now, but certainly during my earlier years, when I was making my way, I would consider myself to carry with me perfectionistic tendencies. I think it's an interaction between genes and culture. So we are born with perfectionistic tendencies, but we exist in environments that emphasize and amplify those tendencies all the time. And for anyone of your listeners, I'm sure they can understand that you go into your first job or even university, but then your first job, it's very competitive. It's very difficult. There's a lot of pressure and expectation on you, and you certainly internalize that and push yourself well beyond comfort. I certainly did that. So I wouldn't say that where I am right now is how I've always been, but certainly in recent years, I've tried to just allow life to happen a little bit more than forcing life to happen all the time. And that's really helped me psychologically, not just break through my perfectionism, but also be a lot happier and more contented.
So would you say that your kind of case study A on the fact that you, if you resonate with this idea of perfectionism, if you feel you have some, it is something you can change?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My whole, when I reflect on my life and how I've managed to make it to what we call a Russell Group University, I suppose, equivalent to the Ivy League in the US, as a professor, write a book, do a TED talk and all these amazing things. I think what's helped me is actually my background, because I never expected to be in where I am. And when you grow up in a small town poor, you kind of get used to the fact that you can't really force your hand in life. Things are going to happen to you all the time that you really can't control. And at some level, you've just kind of got to say yes to as many opportunities as you can, because they don't come around very often. And that was really what I did. So I said yes to go to a grant to go to university. And then I said yes to do a master's, and then I said yes to do a PhD, and then this is kind of just really how it's shaken out. But I wouldn't say that along that road it's been easy. And certainly, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I've put pressure on myself to work really hard, lift myself above other people. So yeah, of course, there's hard work in there. There's a lot of stress and anxiety. Of course there is, but there's also this element, as we mentioned, about having to just let life happen to you a little bit. And it, for me, it's worked out really well.
You and I were talking about this a little bit, that you, given your upbringing, you didn't necessarily have a path, a plan. You went with the flow to some extent. Again, not insinuating there wasn't hard work, but you didn't say this is my 5-year, 10-year, 15-year. And I think too often today, we get told that if we don't have a plan, somebody else will create the plan, and that somebody else will not necessarily have your best intentions in mind. And I don't know if I agree with that, but I don't hear the counter argument often. So if you could tell us your beliefs on, you know, how do you let things happen, but also trust in a decent outcome?
Well, you can never know the outcome. And I think that's the thing. You kind of got to let that go a little bit, because anything can happen, you know, grief, heartbreak, sadness, health scares. If global pandemic comes along, you know, screws everything up. Like, life is a jagged path, and you never know what's around the corner, and many of the things in life you just can't control. And I think that's a lesson, as I said, from growing up poor, where you kind of just have to understand that from day one, that there's going to be a lot of stuff you're going to have to work against, and sometimes you're going to have headwinds that you just can't move forward in, and that's okay. You've got to learn to live in that discomfort a little bit, you know, and that uncertainty, and know that things are going to get better, but at the same time, be comfortable in that, not as comfortable as you can in that space of unknown. And that's not easy. And I've driven myself crazy, I think, throughout my younger years, trying to, you know, really work out where I'm going, what I'm doing, how it's going to work out. Is it going to be okay? Am I okay? You know, these are all very perfectionistic ways of thinking. But it's really only been in recent years, by the way, which having the privilege of comfort, that's to say being in a middle class world now, having a level of pay and wealth that allows me to think like that. I have to also add the caveat, this is a very privileged way of thinking, because you know that when you're not quite so privileged, it's really difficult to, oh well, you know, let's let fly half and what will be. I mean, that could be the difference between losing your tenancy. Or, you know what I mean? Being out of a job. So yeah, I'm always very, it's always really difficult this for me when I reflect on these experiences, because, you know, by the grace of God, things could have turned out way differently for me. And they did for a lot of my friends who you know, have ended up in more difficult circumstances. So, you know, it's, that's the thing about life. You know, there is hard work, of course, as you mentioned, but there's also a lot of luck. There's also a lot of happenstance. There's also a lot of being in the right place at the right time, meeting the right people. You know, these are things that, again, you have to remain philosophical about them, because sometimes you just got lucky. And that's also a way that you can feel gratitude too. And like, you know, that you're here and it's, everything is, you know, happens. I'm a scientist. I don't believe in fate, but sometimes life shakes out in ways you didn't expect. And that's nothing personal. That's just the way the wind blew. And so also I think that helps, you know, me as well, psychologically understand that, you know, I'm really privileged to be where I am. And there's some gratitude there for that too.
Where do we go? This is responsible control and this is over control.
Yeah. But everything in moderation. So everything that I've just said about letting the course of life unfold doesn't mean that you can't work hard. Doesn't mean that you can't be ambitious. Doesn't mean that you just allow whatever's going to happen. You can, of course, have agency. And you know, you look at many, many successful people. Yes, they had luck, happenstance, all the rest of it, but they also worked really, really hard. It's a combination of the two. And the line, I think, is really everything in moderation. Like, it's like anything, like the growth mindset. Take the growth mindset. Great thing. You know, focusing on your efforts, working on developing your talents, all of these things are great, great. But taken to the extreme, like if you force yourself to grow at all times, in all places, no matter what, well, of course, that's perfectionism, because it doesn't let you stop. So you have to, I think in this, the thing is, in this society, everything is about maximization. Everything is about improvement, doing better, being somebody, being anybody. But the person that you are right now in this moment, because there's always more. And that is a, you know, just as much as of an impact on people's perfectionism as you know, this idea that we can be the author of our own destiny, or that we control everything. So I think it's about moderation. It's about understanding that there are limits, that we're just human beings and our resources are not infinite. Of course they're not. And being happy, you know, being content with that, being okay with that, knowing that sometimes we're going to have a nice tailwind. That's great. Work as hard as you can to maximize it. But then sometimes it's going to be a headwind. And that's also okay. We need to learn to be comfortable with that. Standing still is not shameful. And even regressing. So you'll wake up one morning, you go to work, and you realize you didn't know as much about a thing as you thought you did. Because someone's come in the door and told you something that you didn't know. You know, again, these are just normal, natural experiences of being a human being who's, you know, on a journey, on a path to somewhere. And it's all part of the process. And if we try and push and do more and have more, be more all the time, then that's a really exhausting place.
This episode is brought to you by Factor. Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. Fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever you are. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Head over to factormeals.com/smart50 and use the code SMART50 to get 50% off. That's code SMART50, SMART50, at factormeals.com/smart50 to get 50% off.
I got to tell you, this quote, I don't know, might go up on my wall somewhere. Okay. And I just have to tell you, being anybody other than the person you are in this moment, right? Like you were saying, we want to be somebody, we want to be anybody, we want to be anything other than the person we are oftentimes. That's a really profound, yet I believe correct statement, especially for those struggling with perfectionism, right? It's never enough. That's essentially a short definition, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, you can read all sorts of seminal authors, people like Brené Brown, talks about the cultures of never enough and this sense of, you know, needing to do and be and have more. She writes very persuasively about that, speaks very persuasively about that. Other clinicians that I'm writing about in my book, Paul Hewitt, Gordon Flett, you can even go back to the 40s and 50s with Karen Horney and Albert Ellis. All these people have talked about that core deficit thinking at the root of perfectionism. But Chris, there's an interesting symmetry here, I think, between that deficit thinking that's at the root of perfectionism and the way that our whole economy works. We need to be doing more, having more, consuming more, working more, because that's the fuel for growth. If we weren't doing those things, we weren't purchasing, we weren't consuming, we weren't producing, we weren't working, then the economy would spiral into recession in rather short order. So that's why advertising keeps us on our tiptoes. That's why social media bombards us with targeting ads all the time. That's why we're taught to work hard to get through very competitive college and schooling college system. That's why the grind and hustle is at the real core of our working identities, because we have to be keep doing more, working harder, consuming more, held in a state of deficit. Now, you know, I think there's a curious symmetry there. This is something I touch on in the book, because yes, as I mentioned, perfection is genetic. About 30 to 40% of perfection is genetic, but the rest is explained outside in our wider environment. And all I see right now, when I look out into the wider environment, is perfectionistic fantasies about having, doing, being more. And I think that this is something that's very much amplified and emphasized in modern culture, for sure.
Speaking of culture, you told me prior to recording that you live in London. You're from London.
That's right. Yeah, I'm based in London.
Okay. And you're finding a greater resonance in the US with this idea of perfectionism. You're far more global than I am, so I'm just going to open it up. Like, how do you see that? And then what do you think it means?
Okay, thank you, Chris. You pay me as an international player. I'm not really sure.
There you go. Just go with it.
But anyway,
I mean, look, you live in London. You're in Canada right now. I mean,
yeah, it's true. Okay, well, maybe I am. All right, let's go. Okay, so yeah, I'm definitely seeing much more enthusiasm for the topic in the US, 100%. Not to say that I don't read about it, work with people who are perfectionistic in the UK and get asked to do a lot of things in the UK, but certainly in the US, people are really interested in this. Like, they really want to know what's going on here, because I think the US, unlike any other place in the world, is hyper-competitive, individualistic. But these are virtues, by the way. These are things that the US holds to be really important to the national psyche and the national identity, which is great. You know, if you look at across the history, you can see it's driven so much economic innovation, advancement, economic growth. And, no, you know, US today is a powerhouse still, and a success story of what an economy that's driven by these principles can create. Let me just say also, at the same time, we now are in an era where economies are slowing secularly, and it's becoming more difficult to eke out even more growth, because, you know, we're hit a plateau. We're trying as hard as we can to hump the credit pump, to push as much money into the system as we possibly can, to try to squeeze as much as we possibly can out of workers. And revenues through all sorts of different ways of advertising products and all the rest of it. And America is a real interesting case study in how that fixation on profit and money has kind of infiltrated every sphere of life, from the online realm to in our communities. And these, you know, it's unlike any other country in that respect. And so I think perfectionism here is really live, because those pressures to be more, have more, do more, work harder, inside an economy that isn't quite growing as fast as it was when those ideals were giving something to back to people. You know, you had a burgeoning middle class, the affluent society. You know, the average Joe was celebrated with some, you know, the Flintstones, Jetsons. These were kind of in the 40s, 50s, 60s. These were like the celebrated people in US culture. But now it's the 1%. Now it's the unicorn achievement. Now it's the Kardashians. Now it's these unrealistic figures who we all aspire to be and try to be, but of course we just cannot be because it's wholly improbable that we'll ever make it to that really select and elite realm. And I think all of these pressures, all of these factors create in the US a very unique culture of perfection. And I think a lot of people are struggling with that, and that's why they want to know more.
You just mentioned that a lot of people are struggling with it, especially in the US, and I would agree that to be true. Why is it, though, that perfectionism has to be a struggle?
Well, it depends which way you look at it. If you look at it like at a societal level, like this, each individual person struggling to do more, have more, be more, in the aggregate moves the economy upwards, right? Creates jobs, helps businesses flourish, drives investment back into the economy, all the rest of it, right? So in the aggregate, it's a really good thing. But at an individual level, for each individual person slogging under the vice of an economy that needs them to do more, work harder, be more, and all the rest of it, that can be really a difficult thing. And I think that's really at root. Let's take, if you just think about this thought experiment from the other direction, right? So just imagine for a moment that each and every person in American, British, Canadian society felt like they had a good enough standard of life, right? That all their needs were met, that they didn't need anything else, that they were happy and contented in who they are, where they are right now in this moment. What would happen? Well, they wouldn't need to consume for one thing. They wouldn't feel the need to work every hour of the day for another. You would start to see businesses close because of a lack of demand. That would create an impact on the things we need because we wouldn't have the money to fund healthcare, education, housing, and all the rest of it. So the whole fabric of society as we know it would begin to disintegrate. So if you think about it from the other direction, you begin to see how important it is that individual people in those economies continue to feel like they're not enough, continue to feel like they need more, have more, do more, because if they didn't, everything else would come crashing down tomorrow. So for me, it's a cultural phenomenon, as I describe it in the book. It's a systemic way of thinking that is particularly pervasive in economies that are geared towards the maximization of growth, and growth at all costs. And you see it more in those economies, so America, US, Canada, than perhaps you do less in economies that are not quite there yet, although most of our countries are coming in this direction, if that makes sense.
One of the things that I can hear some people thinking, I can literally hear something my listeners thinking, right? Which is, yeah, those politicians, those rich people are the ones doing it. I imagine that this is more of the outcome of the system we have created, and it is not done by anyone intentionally. Do you believe that to be true?
Yeah, 100%. Okay. 100%. I don't think that there's some evil doer overseeing all of this at all. I think this is just, I mean, look, this is just basic economics. This is how, it's nothing sinister. And I mentioned, it's worked. You know, this is the only way we know how to lift economies out of people and economies out of intense deprivation. You know, it's saved hundreds of millions of lives. There is nothing evil going on here. Growth is a very good thing. It's an incredibly good thing. The problem is economies reach a point at some level where the impact of more growth on people's well-being begins to decline and wane. And we're in that point now. Like, the more growth we get, the more problems that actually begin to crop up. And you see things like life expectancy fall in the US right now as is happening. You see social mobility decline. You see happiness wane. You see mental health problems spike. And I think it's countries in this, once they've drawn themselves out of scarcity, right, into an area of abundance, the issue is now not growth. The issue is how you get the proceeds of that growth to the people. And that is an issue of distribution rather than a problem of growth. And I think that is where we are right now in the West. And what we're doing instead is we're continuing to try to eke out more and more growth out of already maxed out economies, which is having an impact, not just on, by the way, you know, debt. If you look at amounts of debt, it's crazy. You lurch from one debt crisis to another, we could be entering another soon. You've got issues about around planetary limits too, like the over exploitation of fossil fuels to generate this growth, which is having an impact on the environment, as we see all around us, but also people, right? The more you try to squeeze people relentlessly, the more that's going to impact on them. And so I just think we in rich developed countries, our problem is not necessarily a growth problem, it's a distribution problem. That's not to say we shouldn't focus on growth, we should, but that's also, but we also need to work out how we make sure that the abundance that we have managed to accrue is shared.
Shared within the country or shared globally?
Shared within, well, yeah, okay.
I mean, and I don't want to go no, too
you're
far
right.
down
yeah,
because-
Yeah, it's an absolutely adequate question. My position is we need to be, the countries right now that are in the developing world need to be encouraged and given the tools to grow. And there should be no limits on that growth because that's so important. Countries in the developed world that have reached a period of abundance, well, within those countries, we need to figure out how we're able to distribute the proceeds of that growth more evenly, because I think that will solve a lot of the problems that we're seeing. And also, you know, figure out how to prioritize growth in areas that need to grow, like green technologies and all the rest of it, and AI and all of these things that can make our lives manifestly better by doing all the drudgery of work and giving us more time to do other things that we would enjoy, right? So those things absolutely need to grow. But then there are other things that are very polluting or that are predatory that perhaps we might say, well, these sectors may have to degrow or whatever. So there's a kind of a balance that needs to be struck. But we're not, I suppose what I'm saying, we're not thinking about that. We're just thinking about how we can grow. And I think that has knock-on impacts. And one of them is perfectionism, but there are all sorts of others.
Well, and if you're listening going, man, we've come some way from perfectionism, I have two things to say. One, we're going to dig back in. But two, it's all tied. And I just can't help it because this is a fascinating discussion that I wasn't anticipating, but I'm glad we went to. And here's why. I'm currently on the final week of a 1-month paternity leave. So we've got a 3-week-old. And so I haven't had to work for 3 weeks coming on 4, which is a long span, especially in the US. Like there are people who go their entire working life and never take a month off straight. And it has been a very saddening month. And here's why. I have done more in 3 weeks for myself, for my joy, for my health, for my family in 3 weeks than I've done in the previous 3 years easily, which is what I believe to be life. And what I've realized is exactly what you're talking about, which is this should be normal for us. We should be able to have this. We, especially in the US, I'm speaking here because this is what I know, but we have the resources and the capabilities to make this happen. And I believe the reason we're not is for exactly what you're talking about, right? Because if everybody were to do that at different times, we might lose 1% growth or something. Not 90. We're not regressing. We're just not exponentially progressing. And it reminds me of, there was this futurist I read about a long time ago. He said, you know, by 2000, a third of our time will be spent on work. In comparison, a third will be spent on hobbies and a third will be spent on relaxation. And in fact, the opposite has happened, right? We're working harder. And I just, all of it seems backwards, but it is feeding into exactly what you're talking about. And it's frustrating.
Yeah, it's crazy that John Maynard Keynes wrote a very famous note to his grandchildren. Where he predicted that, this was around the 40s, 50s, something like that, I can't remember exactly the date, where he predicted that technology would advance to such an extent that we would spend more time in our communities, with our friends and our families than we would at work, because we wouldn't need to work because machines would be doing everything for us, right? And you're absolutely right. The opposite has happened. Now, we have an opportunity with AI, actually, to reverse that,
exactly.
Reverse that trend. Which I really think right. We should jump on. Like, everyone's so scared of AI, but I think if we can use it right, we can really It can bring so, it can enliven our lives in so many ways. Because it doesn't, it won't take.
But we won't. Well, we won't. You know we won't. Well, this is why I bought Amazon, Microsoft, Tesla. I bought the stock, not because of the company, but because I have this negative view that there will be a monopoly, whoever gets there first to some extent, and they will exploit it. And now the richest person will be worth $100 billion, not $5 billion. And that's what frustrates me.
It's frustrating, but I really think there's an opportunity. And the problem is, like, you're right. At the moment, the way the economy works is that all of those productivity gains will be siphoned upwards towards whoever is the first to win the race. Like, that's how it works. But I think, I hope, and the optimist in me hopes, that if we can just use these technologies in ways that free us all from the drudgery of work, and there's almost like an AI dividend. And you can implement that in many different ways. Some say you can implement like a UBI, you can put a floor under deprivation, or you can you can simply just allow people to share jobs, for instance, right? Do part time, but people because, you know, AI is doing more jobs, it means you've got less work available, so everybody kind of does part time work instead of full time work, right? So there's all sorts of ways that you could use this to really give us more time back, like just in the way that John Maynard Keynes said that we would be using technology. I think it's a choice. It's a choice. And the optimist in me hopes that we make the right one. But I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, and they may not.
You know, no progress happens quickly. There is a quote that my wife shared with me long, long ago. One of the things that made me fall in love with her, and it is, you know, nature does not hurry, yet everything is accomplished, right? And I think that we can do things over time, and we will go ebbs and flows, and we will screw it up. But then in the long run, if it gets better, and I think that we have to at least have these discussions. We have to at least write these books. We have to at least learn about it so that our kids start to be a little smarter, so that their kids start to be a little smarter. So over time, we look back 100 years and we go, man, I can't believe those people did that. Because the truth is, you can say today sucks, but do you want to live in 1923? Absolutely not. And so I think we have to remember that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also really important to remember that AI isn't going to rob us of AI. Technologies can only use what we give them, right? What's available. The information, the machine learning can only draw on what's available right now. It can't predict anything. It can't make stuff up from you. It's not a creative or innovative process. Like, that's what people do. People take their jobs, like academics, for instance. We create research papers. We develop theories. We test data. We come up with new insights into which, you know, doing this an iterative process. And it's the same with any other job. If you're a marketer, you come up with a campaign that's new, fresh, exciting, that brings people along, that really sells a product in an innovative way. And it's the same for, you know, law, medicine, whatever. All of these innovations require human ingenuity and creativity. None of that goes in this world. But what does go is the drudgery of the crap task, you know, the admin, the, you know, having to schedule meetings, the real like stuff that gets in the way of that meaning and purpose. And that's why I'm so like, that's why I think, you know, technologies can be really helpful for us, because it can focus our minds on those, that creative side of us, that innovative side of us that really helps drive the economy, whilst also not having to worry about working ourselves to the bone, because all we're ever being asked to do is more. We can focus on quality over quantity. And I think that's a really important shift in the way we work.
Well, I don't want to be the pessimist, but I'm just going to tell you, Thomas, that I think what's going to happen is they will offload these menial tasks to AI, and then they will just say, you know what, because AI is doing all that, we only need one person to do the job of three, but now you have to do that higher level thinking times three instead of spending the time creating PowerPoint. But that's neither here nor there. Let history be our scorecard. With the last kind of 15 minutes or so, I want to get more granular. And if you've listened to this podcast and been like, dude, how are we talking about perfectionism? I think what we just did is we talked about the things that drive perfectionism on a global level, on a countrywide level. I think we've talked about how it impacts humanity, civilization, progression. But now let's talk about, you know, I still got to go to work tomorrow. I mean, I don't, because I'm on paternity, but listening, you do, right? And you have to give that presentation. And perfectionists are worried about screwing up. let's talk about, first of all, how is it a trap exactly, as you define in your book?
Well, Chris, just to say also, I'm sure listeners will also think, how on earth did we get here? But it's really important to recognize that what we just talked about is crucial for the perfectionist, because what we do right now is we blame ourselves a lot of the time. Like, how on earth, why do I have these feelings? Why don't I feel like I'm enough? Why can't I snap out of it?
Mm.
And actually, if we understand that this is just a systemic way of thinking, it takes a lot of personal power and responsibility off ourselves. And that is incredibly healing. Like, just that knowledge itself is so healing, because it gives us permission to accept that there's a broader context to these feelings. And that actually, I just live in this world that pushes on those perfectionistic tendencies all the time. And that's okay. I can accept that. I can acknowledge that. I can label these things. And I can find more compassionate and constructive ways to move forward. So there's actually an important part of discussing those broader issues, because they help us break down why does we feel like this, which then helps us understand ourselves better, which allows us to deal with these tendencies in a much healthier way. So rather than kind of trying to push through, put it all on ourselves, ask ourselves, why on earth can't we snap through this? We can accept that actually sometimes this is just the way it is. So that's the first thing to say.
So insightful. I'm so glad you said that, because although subconsciously I knew there was a tie, I don't think I knew it that clearly. And I'll give you a quick example. Recently, somebody asked me, you know, hey, there's a potential for this promotion at work. Do you want to put yourself up for it? And I thought about it and I said, nah, not really. And it was like I kicked somebody's puppy. They looked at me and they were like, well, then what are you even doing here? And I had this moment of realization, which was just like, I kind of like what I'm doing. I get to spend time with my kids. I don't work more than 40 hours a week right now. I make good enough money. I live in a house I love. Why do I have to rock that boat? But the pressures are immense. And it is exactly what you were just talking about. And it's very easy to give into.
No, not at all. But that goes back to your question that you were asking me. Why is it a trap? Well, that's the trap because of this idea that it's all on us, and that we have to make ourselves appear and perform perfectly at every single moment. And but it's something that we cannot do sustainably. Like, it isn't something that, you know, we can't be excellent all the time. And also there's another piece to this, because even if we are excellent, we just set a new floor for expectation. So the better we do, the better we're expected. It's like trying to chase the horizon. The closer you get, the further it moves. And this is the trap of perfection, this unrelenting treadmill of expectation and pressure and achievement and expectation and pressure and achievement that never really goes anywhere, that never really ends. And that's at essence, that is the perfection trap. And it's just as much as a personal obsession as it is a societal one.
Is that the cure for perfectionism? Is almost gratitude?
Gratitude, and much like master clinician Karen Horney talked about way back now in the 1950s, the goal of therapy for the perfectionist is to try to return the patient to themselves. And that is really quite a profound... that left an impression on me, because she talks something about things like self-acceptance and a wholehearted commitment to living with all of ourselves and all of our feelings. And by the way, every single one of us will know what this feels like. So if you've ever felt love for a human being, like just in that moment when everything else disappears and all you have right there is that intimate connection of just living inside that joy. Kids do this all the time, by the way. You see this in kids all the time, just completely content with themselves and all of their feelings in that moment, not worrying about anything else around them. There is a human capacity for us to connect with ourselves to such an extent that nothing else matters and that we just live and experience that spontaneous joy that comes with existing. That is what Karen Horney talked about when she talked about connecting with ourselves. Now, of course, look, we're not going to, if we don't live in a constant state of that joy, but the goal is to try and experience that joy in ever greater regularity. That's the goal. Because at the moment we're robbed of those experiences for our perfectionism. I think Brené Brown called perfection the thief of joy. And that's very true. We just don't give ourselves permission to experience contentment, serenity, just living and existing inside of ourselves. So that's the, if you want to get at the root of how we overcome perfectionism, for want of a better word, it's really to try to connect with our inner selves, our true selves, our authentic selves.
I feel like the hardest part of that is doing it in a world that wants you to be anything but that, as we've discussed. Have you found any recommendations in either your life or in your research on how to combat that? You know, I just imagine the person listening to this on their commute saying, hey, yeah, sounds great. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Thomas. Assholes, right? I'd love to be my authentic self, but I'm going into somebody who's going to tell me my authentic self is incompetent. You know, how can we do that?
Yeah, it's really important. And I've had this a lot. The answer to that question is, first of all, to recognize this is not your fault. Like that, knowledge is power, right? That's what they say anyway. But in this case, it's really true. Like, understanding there's a broad context to the way that why we feel like this, why all of us feel like this, I think is incredibly healing. And there's a lot of comfort we can take from that. But beyond that, there are many things that we can do in our own lives. The first is to try as much as we possibly can to let life in, let life happen. Understand that life is a jagged path, and sometimes things are going to go well, sometimes things are going to not go so well. That's okay. It's all part of the process. And being brave, being vulnerable, pushing ourselves out there. If you're on a commute this morning and you have various things that you don't think you're very good at and you want to hide them, maybe public speaking is one of them, hear this a lot, put yourself out there today. Go into the office, say, I want to give that talk next week. Let me do it. Let me lead. And go with the feelings. You know, just sit there with the anxiety and discomfort. Don't try and repress it or work around it, but just actually sit in that state of discomfort. Become as comfortable as you can. I feel the fear and do it anyway. This is kind of a very common thing that people say, but that's really important to do. Like, just feel that fear, do it anyway. And then go through the process of actually doing it. You know, push yourself out there, give the talk, and then ask yourself, okay, was that as horrendous as I thought it was going to be? Often it's not. Most of the time it's not as catastrophic as you think it's going to be. But even if it goes badly, this is also a really nice learning experience. You know, what can I do better? How can I improve? How can I learn? How can I take that experience and be better next time? And it's those small steps in a forward direction that make the most difference. You know, pushing ourselves out, learning, growing, sitting with the discomfort, learning to be more comfortable in that state, and then doing it again and again and again. And the other thing I would say is, try not to get too focused on being excellent or excelling in absolutely everything. So yes, you know, if you're not a very good speaker, that's fine, you can become better. But there are certain things that we do in our lives that bring us a lot of joy, a lot of happiness, but we withhold ourselves because we don't think we're a world champion at it. And I see this a lot in perfectionistic people. And really knowing and understanding that we're imperfect, that we're not, you know, going to be brilliant, and everything gives us permission to go out there, do the things we love. Don't hold back, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And there's loads of examples of that in my own life, like music. I'm a good musician, a songwriter. It's helped me through some of the lowest points in my life, but at the same time, I can't sing. And so I would hold myself back because I didn't think I was very good at it. Again, if it's baking, if it's sports, if it's anything you do at work, you know, there are things where we just think we hold ourselves back because we don't think we're going to be excellent at it. So we just don't do it at all. And again, it's really about putting ourselves out there and doing things, and knowing that we're not going to be perfect, and that's okay. And then finally is self-compassion. I know this is a very common one. I'm sure your listeners have heard this a lot. They're going, okay, yeah, here we go again. But it's so, so important. I can't emphasize enough how important it is to be compassionate to ourselves all the time. And particularly when you screw up, because if you're putting yourself out there, you're going to screw up. You need to be kind to yourself. You need to tell yourself, it's okay, next time, it's all right, don't worry. We're just imperfect people, and that's absolutely fine. We can grow and we can develop for ourselves for next time. So those are the things that I try and do in my own life. There's a lot of evidence to suggest they work, but it's not easy, and it's a journey. And you might never get there, by the way. You know, you might never overcome your perfectionism completely, but that's okay. The most important thing is to be on the journey.
As you were going through that, what I realized is you mentioned this idea of just put yourself out there, try to grow from it. But there's a difference between put yourself out there, try to grow from it, have compassion for yourself, and put yourself out there, evaluate your flaws, make sure you fix them. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be done with such intensity. There's this phrase, feedback is a gift. And I've always struggled with it because I felt like, so if every time I go do my job, there's somebody there telling me about what they think I could have done better or different, what's the point? Does it really have to be every time? It just seems, again, like part of that cultural component.
Yeah, and but that's the most important thing about actually putting yourself out there, because if you're compassionate to yourself, sometimes you can also know that there was nothing sometimes, if, like you just mentioned, in failure or in screw-ups or whatever, there's nothing actually to learn. There's no growth to be made. You knew what to do. You knew how to nail it because you'd done it before, but you just had a bad night's sleep or, you got into altercation or coming in and really tilted you or whatever. Like, there's all sorts of things that could have happened in your life that day that created the issue, and it was not really you can get your mentor coming up and telling you, well, this wasn't great and you could have improved this or whatever, but actually, like, none of that really matters because you knew all those things. You just had a bad day, and that goes back to that piece about living or trying to live as much as you can in a place of serenity, knowing that life sometimes happens to us rather than the other way around. And understanding it, accepting that helps us accept when things don't quite pan out the way we planned. And it's not an imperative to grow. It's just one of those things. It's just part and parcel of being a fallible human being. And I think that's helped me certainly take a lot of pressure off myself when things haven't gone quite so well.
Well, I hope it'll help those listening. I know it's helped me as well. So Thomas, first, I really appreciate it. The book is The Perfection Trap, Embracing the Power of Good Enough. Where else can our listeners find you other than obviously the book? And we'll link to that.
So I've got a website, tomcurran.com, Tom spelled T-H-O-M, Curran, C-U-R-R-A-N.com. You can Google me, Thomas Curran, and I'll come up on the search, particularly if you combine it with The Perfection Trap. And there are various ways you can buy the book. And if you do buy the book, please do feel free to get in touch, because I'd love to hear from readers.
That sounds awesome. And it must feel nice to go, you know what, just Google my name. When you get to that status, look, just Google me, okay? I don't need to give you a bunch of websites.
Yeah, there's good. There's also a famous British cricketer called Thomas Curran as well. But I'm assuming the listeners will be able to differentiate because I'm not an athlete.
Maybe, although when we hear the accent, we go, I don't know, it could be cricket. I have no idea.
I do both. That's how I moonlight in on the evenings and weekends.
And you call yourself not a perfectionist. Come on, no, I'm kidding. All right, Thomas, appreciate it. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Chris.
A thank you to this week's guest, Thomas Curran. The episode was hosted, as always, by Chris Stemp and produced by yours truly, John Rojas. Thomas's book, The Perfection Trap, Embracing the Power of Good Enough, can be found wherever books are sold. Now for the quick housekeeping items. If you'd ever like to reach out to the show, you can email us at smartpeoplepodcast@gmail.com or message us on Twitter @smartpeoplepod. And of course, you can stay up to date with all things Smart People Podcast by heading over to the website smartpeoplepodcast.com and signing up for the newsletter. That's it for us this week. Make sure you stay tuned because we've got a lot of great interviews coming up, and we'll see you all next episode.